Hey, we called order to the House Revenue Committee this morning. Welcome everybody back. Sorry about the day off yesterday. It won't happen again. We have two bills before us today. I got a sign-up sheet on both. I know we have only one person has signed up on Senate Bill 362, and that's opposed. And I have a note here that Representative Butler would like to come in. He's in general government. They want to go second, in which case we will not start with Senate Bill 362, but we will start with House Bill 3633. Open a public hearing on that and welcome our timber guy. And while you're giving us the staff background, Mr. Yates, if we can have Doug Go and Tom Tuckman, come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3633 authorizes the city or county to establish a community forest authority. Gives it the power to own, acquire, and hold forest property and to issue bonds or other revenue obligations to acquire and maintain private forest land. It declares an emergency and takes effect upon passage. You have two amendments, dash one and dash two. My understanding is the dash two replaced the dash one. So basically, we can discard one of them.
All right, let's hear what this does. Mr. Tuckman, Mr. Go, good morning. Whichever one wants to go first.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for holding this hearing today, and Mr. Chairman, for pronouncing my name correctly. I go through life, people trying to figure out how to say it the right way. But anyway, I appreciate you holding this hearing today. My name is Tom Tuckman. I am a principal with U.S. Forest Capital. We're a forestry and financial services company that's helps landowners with their financing, forest management, environmental needs. And I'm accompanied today by Doug Go, who is the managing partner with Oregon Harrington and Sutcliffe in Portland, Oregon, runs their Portland office. And I'm here to talk about our community forestry bond bill. I'm a forester by background. My business partner is a investment banker, and we have been jointly both witness to and a part of a lot of the forestry discussions that have taken place over the last decade, and needless to say, they're often contentious. As one representative said down in Northern California, everybody loves forests in my district. The only problem is half of them like them standing up and the other half like them laying down. And that's pretty good. That's a pretty good description. That's the difficult thing to work through. But what we've done is try and take a look at different ways to finance large-scale forest land acquisitions that actually brings members of the conservation community, local officials, and the timber industry together. And it's a very difficult task, but it's something that we've been working on for 3 or 4 years with members of those representative constituencies, if you will, and have come up with this community forestry bond concept that we'd like to talk to you about. Let me just briefly give you some background, and I know many of you know this, especially being in Oregon here, like we are. There are dramatic changes taking place in the forest products industry. Historically, timber companies owned timber land to supply their mills. And it was that way for 80, 90 years. In the mid-80s and into the 90s, what happened was high net worth individuals and pension funds started to buy timber as an independent asset class, and they would sell them on the open market. And they achieve very high returns for their investors. And so what happened in the 1990s, especially the late 90s, is Wall Street started saying to forest products companies, don't just look at your forests as independent asset or as supply for your mills. Look at them as independent assets. And so you saw in the 1990s about one quarter of the timberland, industrial timberland, private industrial timberland in this country change hands because of market forces. In addition to that, of course, there are environmental concerns that pushed companies offshore to buy timberland and get supply. And the result has been a large change in ownership in this country and large changes in how those forests are managed throughout the country. Oregon, interestingly enough, while there have been changes in this state, the industrial ownership has remained relatively stable, although it's clear that in the next 12 to 36 months that might change as some of the owners of the of that timberland change. So that's sort of one fundamental that brings me here today. The other fundamental, of course, is increased demand by the public or sectors of the public for different kinds of conservation. And historically, especially on public lands where, in the end, the decision maker is a public official, or on private lands where there's a board rightfully making decisions for their shareholders or for their return needs, there really isn't an opportunity to bring folks together to make decisions. And so what we came up with was an idea to apply the municipal finance market to forest land acquisitions. And very simply, what we'd like to do is work with communities, industry, and environmental community, create local forest authorities, similar to the hospital authorities for nonprofit hospitals, that would have boards representative of those constituencies, issue tax-exempt bonds to fund the acquisition of large-scale forest land. And let me be clear, we're talking about forest lands over values of $30 million or so. There's all kinds of programs ranging from Oregon's land use program to acquisition programs to other programs for local acquisitions. But we're looking for large-scale acquisitions where there aren't those kinds of dollars, where people agree on how to manage that forest. And the tax-exempt revenue market is, the bond market is the only market, capital market out there that achieves that kind of goal. In its simplest form, what we do is we create a forest authority at the request of a local municipality, so it's locally organized and authorized. They create a board that is a quasi-public, quasi-private board. That board works together to develop a management plan, has an arm's-length, willing seller, willing buyer negotiation with a landowner, so there's no regulatory oversight here at all. They agree on a price. They issue the debt. That debt is used to acquire the forest land, and then trees are harvested to service that debt under a management plan that is put together by both the industry, local officials, and the conservation community. And so what you do, and it's, again, in simplest form, you are able to raise large sums of money. You are able to provide a monetization vehicle for the landowner. You're able to provide timber supply, and you have to provide timber supply to service your debt. You have a cost of capital that allows for a lighter touch type of forestry to achieve some conservation objectives. You keep that forest land in large-scale forestry instead of being fragmented into smaller parcels. And you also, like I said before, bring together folks to make joint decisions on how these forests are managed. We have broad and deep support for this concept. We've worked with all kinds of different sectors. While we have no specific transaction in Oregon to date, we, in our research with Doug Goh, have come to believe that we need to create the legislative authority to be able to move forward on something like this if a transaction does take place. And so we are here today to testify in support of this bill. I want to thank Representative Westland, who has supported this bill, along with Representative Knope and his staff, who've worked very hard on this. We've also talked to the Speaker's office, and we have a series of proposed amendments. I'm going to describe those as technical amendments that upon reading the bill, we would like to have accepted. The difference between the dash ones and the dash twos, as you suggested, are just one of the amendments was left out. There's nothing really substantive in there. And I would like to answer, Doug and I would like to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Questions? From Representative Berger and then Marhart.
This might be a very simple question, or you may have even answered it. The municipality creates the authority. Does the municipality own the land?
Very good question. No, it does not. And that's why we call it quasi-public, quasi-private. And also one of the values here. They create the authority. That authority is run by that board. That board hires a private company to manage the forest land. Let me just say, give a worst-case scenario that we work very hard to make sure never happens, and that is, for whatever reason, the authority defaults on the debt. I think this is where you're going a little bit. There's no recourse back to the municipality, financially or with the land. It's a private transaction, and the recourse under that scenario would be, if you will, the bondholders own the property and it would be auctioned up. It's one of the reasons that I think we have such broad support for this. It's really a private sector response to a public sector need. I don't know, Doug, do you have anything to add to that?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Berger. By analogy, let's take the hospital authority situation where we borrowed this concept from. I know that the chair is familiar with hospital authorities, how they work. Cities, counties, and health districts can form a hospital authority. The hospital authority formed by the municipality by statute is not liable for the debts of the authority or the debts of the hospital who comes to the authority, makes improvements to the hospital, builds a new hospital, and the credit for those revenue bonds is solely the credit of the hospital. So there's no recourse back to the municipality. On the other hand, without that municipality's participation and without the creation of the hospital authority, you cannot take advantage of the federal income tax code, which says nonprofit corporations can't borrow on a tax-exempt basis in their own name. They can only do so through a publicly created authority, in this case, the Community Forest Authority. Is that responsive?
Follow up. I live in the city of Coos Bay. We have a hospital district.
Yes, I've worked with them. Very good hospital.
Although I was mayor of the city, and we own land in the watershed. I think that what I'm curious about is how much authority the city has and maybe none if they just simply create this authority in determining what happens on down. In other words, once the forest is managed and cut, do they have any say over where those trees are taken? In other words, let's say that this particular authority is given in my district. When the trees are cut and they are taken to Northern California, does the municipality have any say over that process?
The marketing of the forest, the trees itself, no, they wouldn't. The authority would be run as an independent body, if you will, and they would run that entity to achieve both their financial community development and public benefit goals. And so they would run it pretty much like a business, and they would if you bought forest land for $50 million, they would have a $50 million debt, and they would do what they needed to do in the confines of their management plan and the public benefit to service that debt.
Can I jump in on that for just a second? But under Section 5 of the bill, as I read it, the governing body has the authority to appoint the board and will remove the board. And so while the day-to-day decisions may be the responsibility of the board, they're not going to get too far out of line with the governing body of the municipality to establish the authority, because that the municipality has the ability then to yank their chain and even pull them off the board.
That's correct. And there is a requirement for a member from the municipality governing body to be on the board. So there is, I was speaking about a direct good clarification, and I was speaking about the specific day-to-day operation.
Doug, were you going to, Rizzo, you were going
to? That was the point. I was, Mr. Chair, you beat me to the punch there.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I have an even more fundamental question than the ones that have been asked so far, and it's probably my obtuseness that I haven't gotten it yet. I understand why we have a stock market and why we have stock companies, you know, sort of things that have been around for several hundred years now, because it turns out they were useful economically to allow people to pool resources and get on with the business enterprise. At that level, describe why this is useful.
I'll take a first cut, Doug, and you can take a second cut. Since the early 1900s, the capital markets themselves created this municipal financing vehicle. And I think the best way to describe this is, for those areas or issues where there is some sense of public debate or discussion, or where the private sector in its purest form may not provide a service, and let's take hospitals, where a private hospital won't site because there's not the economic viability to do so, but there is a public benefit. You need to have a hospital in part of rural Oregon. What the government did is say, we'll create tax exempt revenue bond market. It's about a $3 trillion market, so this is not a small market. It's a very, very large market. And in exchange for tax exemption on federal income tax for your bond investors, we want you to provide some kind of a public benefit. And in simplest form, we're trying to apply that concept to forest acquisitions. Because of the changes, and I could go on and on about the changes, in timberland ownership in this country, for economic reasons and environmental reasons. And I think everybody would agree that there's huge public policy debates about this. We believe that this kind of ownership class can, through the private markets, achieve public benefits. And it's something that, in my 20 years of working in forestry, I've actually been surprised it's garnered as much support. And what I say by that, it's not that we haven't tried. It's just we've been working on this for 3 years now. And like I said, we have this variety of interests. So, does that answer your question? I mean, it's a public benefit market.
Okay. Sort of a follow-up then. So it sounds like there's several kinds of issues. One is that this is another mechanism for getting conservation and economic interests formally working together in an enterprise which is partly economic and partly environmental and partly conservation. Part of what it sounds like.
And I should add another important, and community development.
Okay, and community development. And if I understand you correctly, you're financing it both because of the scale issues involved, and also because you're going to get your debt costs at a lower rate because of the government bond funding. I mean, the tax exempt bond funding.
That's correct.
Okay.
Representative Pence.
I just was following that. What are the clear public benefits here? What are the public benefits?
The public benefits, well, first of all, we believe that the public benefits should be defined by the Forest Authority itself. And we think that we tried to draft this in a way that established the participation on these boards in a way that would define the public benefits. So, give the following answer. The public benefits could range from an array of different things. They could be, first of all, primarily acquisition of a large-scale forest as working forest. If you have a 100,000-acre forest and it's being threatened by conversion to other use or mills that cannot afford to buy timber or mills that are impacted by federal timber supply reductions, having a large-scale forest that continue to work is going to provide an array of benefits. It's going to provide supply for mills. It's going to provide for buffers for anadromous fish. It's going to provide for recreational opportunities. It can provide, and it's a specific provision of the bill, as debt is paid off, it can provide funding for local communities as that local community defines it. So instead of trying to be prescriptive in this bill and lay out the 20 different things that are public benefits, what we tried to do was describe the types of folks that should work together to describe that public benefit.
Yeah, go ahead, sure.
I haven't said that. We could do that.
Well, it sounds like a natural forest. I mean, don't we kind of have that mechanism in place of public land?
Let me just answer. That is a good question. It is not a national forest, and the reason it's not a national forest is on national forests, I'm going to be simple again, you have industry and environmental folks through public involvement processes arguing to a public decision maker about how many trees they want cut and saved. In the end, even if you have these advisory committees, it's that public land manager that makes the decision. That public land manager is influenced not just by the people of a community, but by folks all over the country. I'm a supporter of public land management. We have a lot of public lands. What we've got here is a local municipality where they've given the decision-making authority about how many trees to cut and how many to save to a group of people that make that decision on a day-to-day basis. So it is very, very different. It's very, very different in my mind.
That's true. Doug, if you want to follow up on that, then we'll pick up Representative Barnard.
Okay.
And Representative Farr.
Yeah. Chair Shetterly, Representative Hass. I think the other point is that the bill provides flexibility to create the nonprofit authority, but also allows the nonprofit authority, just as a hospital authority can loan the proceeds of revenue bonds to a nonprofit hospital. In this case, you can loan the proceeds to a nonprofit corporation set up for the purpose of having this combination of business interest, community interest, the kind of balance of conservation and business enterprise, be able to preserve the forest lands, but also harvest the forest lands in order to repay the debt. And by doing so, as to Representative Barnhart's earlier questions, be able to access on a larger scale the debt markets as opposed to the equity markets and on a tax-exempt basis.
Representative Fox.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions, if I may. You mentioned funding for communities. I just kind of want to make sure I understand that. Potentially, let's take Lane County. This seems like something that may be more attuned to counties than cities.
I think that's right.
If Lane County were to acquire or were to set up a forest authority, potentially money generated by the harvest of timber in that forest authority could go to Lane County's general fund for distribution to... Yes. For spending on roads or whatever it wanted. Okay. And if a municipality were to engage in this activity, would it typically be outside of the urban growth boundary of the municipality? I mean, does this bill provide for that sort of activity?
Yes. It would. That's a very good question, and I'll be honest, I hadn't thought of that. These large-scale forests are typically outside the urban growth boundary. Having said that, and the only reason I'm wondering is we have a similar kind of situation up outside of Seattle, and it's one of these situations where half of the forest is in and half is out just because of the way it's laid out. I don't know if there's a problem with that. If there is, we can certainly develop language to address that one way or another.
But there's no geographical limitation in this. If Lane County wanted to buy up a nice piece of land in Clatsop County, as I understand, the Lane County Forest Authority could buy it up in Clatsop County or any county that it wants. As I understand under the bill, it's not limited to activities within the jurisdiction of the authority that's established, the governing body.
Chair Shetterly, that is correct in terms of geographic, although how we would interpret the bill and I think how we've intended to draft the bill, and similar to what hospital authorities have done, is to say in that example is that to the extent that there was a forest authority in Clatsop County and one in Lane County, that the Lane County authority would look to work on a joint basis with the Clatsop authority to the extent that one existed, to make sure that they worked on a kind of intergovernmental agreement basis or otherwise by agreement. Although I think you're right. Technically, there's nothing that limits them geographically. Clearly, the bill contemplates that you might have multiple counties who would work together, multiple authorities that would work together to acquire forests that overlapped, several counties, which I think is the case you'd have in Central Oregon.
Okay. I want to pick up Representative Berger. She had it. I want to get down to the left end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I had a different question, but I'd like to pursue this just a moment further, if you don't mind, because this is an interesting question. Let me ask my first question before I forget it. This is a very interesting proposal. There are forests all over this country, and obviously you've talked to other folks. Has anyone done this? Do you have a model existing where it's happened?
No. Yes and no. And let me describe that. As you know, every state creates their own issuing authorities to issue tax-exempt debt on behalf of nonprofits or themselves. We have worked with two groups of communities, one in Northern California in Redwood Country and the other in outside of King County, Washington. And we've created two of these entities. These are actually private nonprofit groups, not forest authority or instrumentality, which is, I'm getting into technical mumbo-jumbo, it's in my statement. We reached an agreement with Weyerhaeuser Company with our Evergreen Forest Trust in King County to acquire 100,000 acres for $185 million outside of Seattle about a year ago. That fell through because the clarification we needed regarding private use didn't come through in time, and Weyerhaeuser sold it to another company. That is the closest we've gotten. Through our financial due diligence, we know that the financing associated with this works. We've worked with large firms such as Seattle Northwest Securities, who you may know, Bear Stearns, Stone & Youngberg, preeminent bond municipal law firms as Orrick, Herrington, Sutcliffe, and Ader Wynn here in Oregon. Large forest management companies, the Campbell Group out of Portland, which is a timber investment management organization with about $1.6 billion in assets. We know the financing works. What we need is the authority, create a forest authority, if you will. And so that's where we are right now. There's a little bit of a catch-22 here. You need the legislate. A landowner that has a public, especially a public company, is not going to engage with a buyer such as this for the first time without knowing that you can close a deal within six months or so. That was our experience in Washington. The flip side to that is, I think, the basis of your question is, you know, if we do that, if you authorize this, can you do these transactions? There's a little bit of a catch-22, and what we're here today and why we're here ahead of a transaction in Oregon is because we feel, based on our experience in Washington, that we need this authority up front.
Sure.
If I could follow up with the other question that came to my mind under the discussion. Under this enabling piece, What is to prevent Multnomah County, which isn't exactly known for forestry, from buying some under an authority set up here, from going to Coos County and buying a forest, if you will, and using this scheme? Is there anything in here that would prevent that?
Doug, go ahead. Chair Shatterly, Representative Berger, you know, I think that that's something that we could address as a technical matter. Again, how the hospital authority statute works by analogy. For example, a large Catholic health system like Catholic Health Initiatives may own hospitals in Ontario, Pendleton, Baker City, and Roseburg. And when we do a bond issue for Catholic Health Initiatives, we're doing one for the Sisters of Providence now, four different counties. We go to the four hospital authorities, but we designate one of those hospital authorities as the lead authority. And that's really what this bill contemplates. We could certainly insert language in the bill that addressed that issue. There is a technical issue under federal tax law, however, that if this was done on a nonprofit basis, that would require, under federal tax law, when you a nonprofit, a 501c3 organization borrows, you have to have an elective legislative body within the community where the project being financed is located. So in your example, Multnomah County to the Oregon coast, the Oregon coastal community, let's say Coos County, would have to approve that bond issue in order for Multnomah County to do a tax-exempt financing in Coos County. But again, we could certainly address that situation more directly in the bill. The bill certainly contemplates in that situation that the Multnomah County, in that case, would go to Coos County and say, we want to have an agreement that we can do this, work together on this. And that's what the bill currently contemplates, but we certainly could tighten that up.
I think you'd probably want to see that. You say it's already in de facto a requirement.
Right.
It's a federal law.
Right.
It'd be helpful, I think. Otherwise, just imagine driving it. Welcome to Coos County.
Half-owned by...
Right. No, understand the concern, and I'm not prepared to tell the chair this morning that, you know, technically that's addressed. I think we've tried to address it, but we should take back and narrow that down.
It's
certainly not the...
No, yeah. I understand.
Yeah.
Representative Farr.
Actually... That got to the heart of my question.
There's an advanced set of questions. I was going to get to him. I have just a couple. Thinking about this. Is there any limitation either in the bill or in otherwise that limits ownership to the state of Oregon? Could a municipality go across the river? I'm not trying to be too wild,
right.
But just as a matter of fact, is there any such limitation? I'm not suggesting we want one. Maybe.
Right.
But they can't own
Washington.
Now. They can't own property in Oregon. They have to buy it out of state.
Chair Shatterly, Section 2 of the bill says in order to provide the people of the state of Oregon with renewable forest resources, we certainly, that language is taken from the Hospital Facility Authority statute. It's been our view, interpreting that language over the 30 years the Hospital Authority statute's been in, is that would not allow us to do financing, say, in the state of Washington. But, however, again, if that was an issue, we could make that tighter as well. Certainly what's contemplated here is only doing financings. And, again, I think municipality, we could also tighten that up to mean, you know, a city or county in the state of Oregon. But we certainly could address that. But I do think certainly Section 2 is intended to mean that it's state of Oregon-based forests.
Well, actually, I'm not so sure that I'd be bothered by the authority to invest out of state, but that's for others. The other question I had was property that's owned, then this forest land, does it remain on the tax roll? It's owned by a nonprofit. Now, this authority, does it stay on the tax roll or does it come off the tax roll?
The Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I don't believe that, I think that would, there's nothing in the bill that addresses the property tax exemption, and that is something that would otherwise be governed by state law, and I believe it would be continue to be subject to taxation.
Just,
But Tom, I don't know if that's consistent with the intent, but that's, I believe, what under as currently drafted.
Practically speaking, and this, Representative Berger, gets to your point as well. I mean, the whole point here is to try and local property taxes are, I know you know, are exceedingly important. Getting back to your question, we've worked on financial models on this with 10 different landowners. Every single time, the group of people that we've worked with that either became or hope to become a forest authority have said that's one of our top priorities. So our cash flows, when we work out the valuation, always include property taxes and actually every other tax. So getting back to Doug's point, that is clearly both the intent and the practical application, and if we need to specify that.
Okay. I missed it. It's in, Dick pointed it out to me in Section 13, that a community forest authority is deemed a municipal corporation. All assets and income and the bonds are exempt from all taxation in Oregon.
Hmm.
And then in sub 2, which is notwithstanding sub 1, real and personal property owned by the authority and leased to a third party. So it may depend on how the management arrangement is set up. It's one thing, I guess, if the board owns it and then just hires a forest manager to manage it, I wouldn't construe that as a lease. That would probably take the property off the tax roll if they buy it and then they lease it to Weyerhaeuser or to Hampton or to somebody else.
Right.
Then I suppose it goes on the tax roll under this draft.
And Chair Shetterly, my comments earlier were really addressing a situation where, like in the hospital situation, the authority loans the proceeds of the revenue bonds to a nonprofit corporation. So the nonprofit corporation is the owner as opposed to the authority itself. But I appreciate the pointing out the reference. So I agree with your point. In addition, I think a nonprofit corporation, to the extent it owned it, would be subject to the general property tax rules of the state, which generally provide that they are subject to, with a very few exceptions, are subject to property taxation, just like private corporations.
Well, that'd
be
worth at least tracking down. John Phillips isn't here. I'd call him up right now and have him tell us that. But it'd be worth at least tracking that down and how that works. Representative Barnhart?
I think this is sort of a follow-up, and it gets back to maybe the original or basic authority of this organization. The purpose of it is to hold forest land and to manage it. Is that right? Or and forest land in this case means land which is being used for growing forest crops, mostly trees, and doing conservation things in addition to that. Could an organization like this set up a park in some portion of that land, for example?
I think there's a couple questions. I'm going to answer I took two questions.
There's two or three, or maybe four.
The Forest Authority is number one in issuing authority. Okay, so they can issue. They have the authority to issue tax-exempt revenue bonds for acquisition of forest land.
Right.
These are revenue bonds, so the revenue needs to be generated from the forest harvest.
Correct.
Okay. If you're talking about 100,000 acre property or 50,000 acre property, maybe this board says, I'm throwing out a number, 5,000 acres of that we want to set aside for some unique ecological reason. Okay? Take it off the timber volume. They could choose to do that. If you want to call that a park or a set aside, you know, so
a conservation set aside.
In that sense, yes. The second thing it can do is issue debt on behalf of private nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to let Doug correct me where I'm wrong here, being the forester, dabbling in tax law. I apologize.
All dabble in tax law.
I apologize in advance. If a private nonprofit is formed, they do not have the authority to issue debt on behalf of themselves. They have to go to an issuing authority. So the forest authorities that we are trying to establish here could either issue debt on behalf of themselves, if that's what the municipality chooses to establish them to do, or they serve as sort of an overseer if a private nonprofit comes to them to make sure that the public purposes for which that forest authority was created are being met. Doug, did I do that right?
Very well done.
Okay. I could answer your question.
Is there some restriction in the federal rules that allow for a non-taxable interest on these bonds that the underlying authority be tax-free? Or is that simply part of the financing in this situation?
Are you getting to the private use issue?
Correct. Because a lot of this looks like we're being a private landowner who's going to cut some trees and sell them, and that ought to be subject to property tax.
At the risk of making a relatively complicated subject more complicated. If the nonprofit is a private, and this is what I was referring to back in the Evergreen Forest Trust example. We need a clarification in the federal tax code that says that forest growth can be used to service your debt. Okay. We are working on that. We have again bipartisan support at the federal level. Actually, Senator Smith and Senator Murray are working together on that. I'm going to set that aside for a second. In that case, as Doug suggested, it's basically state tax law drives that local tax law impact. Okay. If the state of Oregon chooses in establishing forest authorities to make that a requirement, that would be incorporated into the nonprofit's cash flows. Okay, and that's something we always intended, by the way, and as I said before, our practical experience has always been a part of every transaction we've looked at. If it's the forest authority itself that buys the forest land, from our standpoint, it's the same concept. It's the intent is that property taxes are paid because one of the goals here, public policy goals, is community development, community stability, providing funds for all those things that especially rural parts of Oregon are facing and battling with today. So either the forest authority can own the property and pay those taxes, or the nonprofit, by going to that forest authority to have debt issued on their behalf, pay those taxes.
Representative Hans, you had a question before you stepped out. Did you get back to that? Okay.
Well, it appears to me then, Mr. Chair, as though Section 13 is probably not drafted correctly.
Maybe some clarification, yeah.
Well, I mean, if in fact the land which is in productive use is going to be taxed as we normally would tax land in productive use, right, then this isn't drafted correctly to get there.
Well, I think it's...
Is this that?
I think it's... Doesn't it? As I read it, it specifically excludes the income, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
From taxation.
Well, it says an authority, right, all assets, and
it also includes property taxes unless it's actually leased to somebody else other than the authority.
No, it includes those.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Barnhart, I think the intent as drafted really was in the case where the authority was truly going to be the owner and the operator and the manager of that forest, that it be excluded from property taxes. I think now, from a policy standpoint, if the committee wants to say we want to make them subject to taxation, that's fine. I think what it also contemplates is, however, if it were to lease, just as if a hospital authority leases a hospital to a hospital, a nonprofit, then the tax rules with respect to how the hospital operates is whatever the issue. And I think so that's how this was set up. In addition, what I think is not currently addressed, and I think would just be currently would be addressed by property tax law generally, is if the authority issues the revenue bonds, loans the proceeds to the private nonprofit corporation. In that case, I think that was what Mr. Tucklin was addressing, was that is intended, that nonprofit's ownership of that is intended to be subject to property tax. So I think certainly it's up to the committee to decide whether, as a policy matter, if the authority itself was owning and managing the property, not leasing to a third party, whether in that case it really did want it subject to property tax. I think that's a policy decision for the committee. I think as currently drafted, it was intended that, in fact, it be exempt.
And I can see this playing out in a couple of ways, where if you've got an authority, this sort of gets back to owning the property within the jurisdiction of the authority and outside the jurisdiction of the authority. If you've got an authority that is investing in property within its own jurisdiction, that's one thing. And even at that, though, maybe you want to look at the model we have on others where 51% of the taxing authority or some other taxing authorities agree to that because you've got other taxing...
In lieu of taxes.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. You've got the fire district and the school district and all those who would lose the revenue. And certainly, I think if you're going to be talking about an authority that's buying property outside of its jurisdictional boundaries, some requirement of an agreement with the host jurisdiction with regard mm-hmm. to that property tax mm-hmm. might be in order. It was in Newburn.
Well, and it occurs to me that being cautious on the go-around on something like this, trying to figure out a way to make this transparent for tax purposes makes a lot of sense. I mean, if the land is being used in production, then it should pay whatever the normal taxes are. If it's being used in a way that would normally not be taxed, then it would get the same exemption that any other property would get. I'd be a lot more comfortable if this section were drafted to say that, so that it was transparent regardless of the ownership.
Anything else? One last question, maybe, and this is a bigger policy issue, but what percentage of forest land is publicly owned and privately owned? How does that break down right now in Oregon, counting federal and state and any county forests?
Yeah. I believe it's 55-45.
Okay, and I guess my question, and that's the policy question here, then, this creates a new municipal, basically, investment. It's maybe not a national forest, but it does create new municipal investment in what is now the private forest land market. And I guess that's a question we need to wrestle with, too. As a policy matter, do we want to expand essentially public ownership, even under the guise of the authorities and these nonprofits, into what remains of the already minority private ownership of forest lands? I'm not sure what the answer to that question is, but I think it's a fair one to address, where we already have a minority of our forest land acreage under private management and ownership. Representative Barnett?
Well, and I don't think the case has been made, well, certainly not yet this morning, that would indicate that we need to have some kind of accumulation or large-scale financing for private forest lands, which is, this is sort of a backhanded way of getting at it, seems to me. The model is interesting, and I'd like to think about it a bit, but I don't know that it solves a problem that we have anyway. Now, maybe it does. I just don't know about that problem. And maybe I'm asking another side of the same question you're asking.
Representative Farr.
I may be looking at this over simplistically, but this seems like a good transition between private and national forests, in that it kind of takes the best of both, that it has an authority that really is looking at sustainability in the forest, as well as, you mentioned, buffers for fish, other environmental elements, while at the same time producing supply for mills. And as an aside, local governments have another revenue mechanism that helps them to provide the services they need. I'm really interested in exploring this. This seems like a very good program.
I just thought of one of the things you were saying that's kind of a follow-up on my question, but on the public versus private. Because I'm intrigued by this, too, but we like to, as you can tell, we like to talk about things in this committee. But on the public versus private, do we disadvantage private investment in forest land by creating this opportunity for, let's say, purchase with tax-free bonds? Are you creating an imbalance in the market when you've got forest land up for sale and an opportunity here for an authority to come in on basically better terms than a private landowner holder could acquire because through the use of these tax-free bonds and other advantages?
Another round of questions. I'll answer yours first, Representative Shatterly. There's a cost to the, if you will, there's a cost to the purchaser for the forest authority or the nonprofit for using this lower cost of capital. That cost is providing a public benefit, getting back to Representative Haas' question, whether that is dollars going to the municipality for roads or schools, whether it's taking some of the property and doing a lighter forestry approach. As we witnessed by our experience up in Washington State, the private sector can still meet or exceed a price that a nonprofit can pay because of their, they have a higher cost of capital, but they don't have the coverage requirements of the bonds. They don't have the public benefit requirements of the bonds. They don't have a board that includes industry, conservation, and local officials that define that. So we think no. By the way, and also the other thing about these is that they can't move as quickly. These are subject to negotiated transactions, not auctions where most large-scale timberlands are undertaken. With regard to the public and private ownership, our view, strong view, and if you look at the trends in this country, is that most large forest landowners are disposing of their industrial forest land for the reasons I just described. And what's happening with that forest land, I'm not putting a value on this. I hope I'm not trying to put a political statement here, but what's happening is if you have 50,000 acres, if you're a REIT or a high net worth or just looking at for timber, you're subdividing it, you're fragmenting it under local law, and you're selling it off for real estate development. Not that that's bad, we need it, but this is a tool that helps keep large-scale forest lands working in the context of local zoning. It's a tough one. Sort of standing in the middle of the road, you get run over. But we don't view it as purely private. We don't view it as purely public. It is a somewhat in the middle. It's a privately run entity that provides a public benefit. And we think that given what the trends in forest land dispositions, that is something that has a lot of value, and that's why we have a lot of timber companies as well as local communities and conservation is supporting it.
Very good. It's been a good discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, and look forward to working with you on.
We'll talk.
Thank you. Very good.
Closed public hearing on House Bill 3633, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 362 and invite up Representative Butler and Senator Decker. Who's here? Elizabeth, that's you.
Chairman Shatterly and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with Senate Bill 362A engrossed, I'm just going to talk about the A and Gross bill. There is a -A3 amendment, but that is not being brought forward at this time. So even though you have like a revenue impact statement that says A3, it's the same for the A and Gross bill of Senate Bill 362. So basically with 362, it provides a personal income tax exemption for 7 years for a senior executive manager of a venture capitalist firm that initially has $75 million in available capital to invest and invest at least $2 million in Oregon businesses in the previous 12 months. It allows an income tax exemption for also 7 years for university senior research faculty who conduct new lines of research after January 1st, 2003 and have stable funding of at least $200,000 per year for which commercial applications exist in the research areas of nanotechnology and multi-scale materials and devices that utilize combinations of nanotechnology and microtechnology. Now, it's restricting the personal income tax exemption to only one qualified executive manager per venture capitalist firm, and they have to have the authority to make fundamental decisions for the venture capitalist firm. It requires that the qualified university faculty also make fundamental decisions about the direction of the signature research conducted by the university. It outlines then the initial and annual application process by which the taxpayer will apply to Economic and Community Development Department for certification for the income tax exemption. And the main restriction here is that the department not issue initial certifications for more than 30 senior researchers and 15 executives of venture capitalist firm. It requires then annually for a qualified venture capitalist firm to have at least $75 million in unobligated venture capital, have invested at least $2 million each year in order to get this annual recertification in one or more businesses in the state. It requires a senior researcher to demonstrate at least $200,000 in stable annual funding for annual reapplication. And then it also defines the income that is exempt, which includes wages and bonuses and stock options. It compels the Economic Community Development Department to prepare reports detailing the effectiveness of the income tax exemption for the 2005 and 07 legislature. It applies to initial certifications filed with the department beginning after December 1st, 2003. It takes effect 91 days after the end of session and applies to tax years on or after 2003. And as far as the revenue impact here, it is uncertain as it does depend heavily on the number of new researchers and executives of venture capitalist firms who invest in Oregon businesses, as well as the total personal income per taxpayer that is exempt. There isn't a limit on the total amount that one particular taxpayer could receive from this exemption. And so in this particular revenue analysis, I've just looked at how much it would be for one particular researcher to have receive this income tax exemption each year, as well as one executive of a venture capitalist firm. And so it's roughly in the 2003-2005 biennium, $78,421. In the 2005-2007 biennium, $268,336. And in the 2007-2009 biennium, $486,016.
All right. Who wants to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Tom Butler from House District 60, still looking for jobs for Oregon. This hat comes off when we get some in Eastern Oregon, but this bill is a great jobs bill for Western Oregon, for the more populated metropolitan portion of Oregon. Colleagues, the genesis of this bill actually came during the second special session. A group of our colleagues in the House worked up, and I believe they must have had some cohorts within the Senate, too, that worked on this particular idea of bringing intellectual capital to Oregon, to our universities. And then during the interim, we continued to have meetings with the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development. And the idea, the concept of trying to bring back not just the intellectual capital, which has been drained from Oregon, but also to bring back the venture capital. This is the seed money. If you'll stop and think about how large businesses, high technology business, has come to Oregon, it comes from the planting of the seed, and this basically is the seed as we seek for venture capital to come to Oregon. And then you'll recognize from Ms. Mayer's presentation the very high bar that this sets for anyone who comes to Oregon and brings this kind of business to Oregon. Let me just refer to the venture capital first. First of all, these are already established venture capital firms, and we did have some inquiries as we discussed this during the, I think it was during the fifth special session, that we started to flesh it back out again, that there was some folks from some substantial worldwide global funds that started examining Oregon, and I just have to say that as a result of our discussions during the fifth special session, at least one other state legislature has adopted something similar to this to try and attract venture capitalists to their states. In this particular instance, what we're doing is we're offering a special tax exemption for new to Oregon business that will come here as a venture capital business to start investing in Oregon high-tech businesses. And what this is intended to do is, if you'll think of all business, each business organization as a pinnacle or as a pyramid, at the very pinnacle of which is the leader within the organization. And our attempt in both the intellectual capital to attract intellectual folks to the state of Oregon, as well as within the venture capital, is to make certain that we can attract those folks that are going to invest high amounts of investment capital back into Oregon as venture capitalists, and their staffs will pay income taxes, they will pay property taxes as they move their property, plant, equipment, and businesses into Oregon. Unfortunately, these businesses, some of them, have already been in Oregon and have moved out of Oregon. Our attempt is to try and bring them back in. This is the smallest, the venture capital is the smallest of the pyramid. The pyramid at its base may only have a total of 10 or 12 staff people at the bottom of the base with the one person on the top. What we're after are the high-tech businesses, and I think that there's a list of the high-tech businesses which we could provide to you and which perhaps Senator Deckard may provide. But in that process, what we're looking at is bringing that top person in to bring the high-tech money into the state of Oregon. Their income tax would be, if they apply for an economic development through the Department of Economic Development, their income tax would be waived year by year based upon their performance of bringing their income tax from this particular venture activity would be tax exempt for the work that they bring to Oregon, recognizing that their staff pays income taxes, their business pays property taxes and other kinds of local taxes, but they themselves could have an exemption based upon the fact that we are attracting this business to Oregon. Originally, it was anticipated that there might be 50 people in the United States which would qualify for this high bar that we were setting up. It was later estimated that there are probably less than 50 people in the entire world who fit this category. So we are seeking for those folks who will bring their businesses. And again, as I say, that we've already had some inquiries as we discuss this. Would this be something that some of the Fortune 500 companies of investment could bring to Oregon? And we believe that they could be attracted to that, their venture capital business could be attracted to Oregon. And we encourage your favorable examination of Senate Bill 362.
Thank you very much. Before I ask Senator Decker to join us, I need to excuse myself, and I apologize for that. We've got a 9:45, so I will ask my able co-chair, Representative Verger. Representative Scott, I think you covered last time I was on, didn't you?
I think I did.
Okay. Then Representative Verger, if you would finish up.
I'd be happy to cover for you.
Why not?
All right. Senator Decker, welcome.
Good morning, Vice Chair Verger, members of the committee. I think Representative Butler did a fine job of and your staff of explaining the bill. The only three things that I would add is this is really focused on the fact that we have seen venture flight in the state of Oregon, and it really affects our small businesses that are startups. Obviously, we know the history and the success stories of Boston, Seattle, Silicon Valley, which really have two components. One is world-class research universities, and this proposal comes to you as part of six from the Oregon Council of Knowledge and Economic Development. Our proposal on the university system is down in Ways and Means. It's faring very well, but it is really married to this proposal in the other four. These are the two most significant. One is a signature research center, which really, how do you commercialize? What is our best opportunity to commercialize university research into new Oregon startup companies? The economies of the Bay Area or Seattle are obviously doing very, very well based on this main founding ingredient, that Oregon just unfortunately lacks. Senate Bill 362 comes to you from the Council of Knowledge and Economic Development. It is a very tightly tailored program with the subsequent but-for. And I think that is the key on any incentive program that we put in place, is that the language be but-for. You do not get this incentive, you do not get this exemption, but for the investment of $2 million every single year that you claim it in a 7-year period in Oregon-based startups. That is a guaranteed revenue generator, Madam Chair, because we know that Oregon startups will benefit from having these funds capitalized at $75 million. The only other thing that I might add is if we look back to the early and mid-1990s as a test of whether this works, I would just name a few companies and their experience of starting up and the effect they've had on Oregon's economy. Sequence Computers, first round of venture capital was $5 million. 5 years later, there was 1,850 jobs created. They were listed on NASDAQ and sold to IBM in 1998 for $800 million. Their employees still reside in the state of Oregon. Digimarc, first round of venture capital was 4.5. 5 years later, they're based in, I believe, Hillsboro. 5 years later, there's 338 jobs created, and they are listed on NASDAQ. TriQuint, first round of venture was $5 million. 5 years later, 350 jobs, grown to a $300 million in revenue in 10 years. Mentor Graphics, first round of venture was $1 million in 1981, $2 million in 1983. By 1987, there were 1,500 employees, 75 to 80% of them reside in the state of Oregon. And I would lastly choose Pixelworks, and that's partly because the chair of our op-ed committee is the CEO of Pixelworks. They were founded in 1997. Their first round of venture was 1.25 in 1997. 5 years later, they have 257 workers worldwide, 135 who reside here in Oregon, and the average salary is $81,000. So we know the program works. I think it comes to you with a great deal of care and research from the Oregon Council of Knowledge and Economic Development, and I appreciate the consideration by this committee.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for either of our two presenters? One of the things that kind of caught my attention is the $2 million that is listed in the bill, and then you've named the $5 million venture capital. Tell me how that works, because that's obviously not the initial investment of the company. So I don't think it is, or is it? The list that you just read, and many of them started with the $5 million. Of venture capital. Was that their initial investment, total initial investment?
Correct.
Was.
It was their first round. And it really is the seed money. You have the idea, and that is your seed money to, before you can market the product, to really begin to grow your initial company. And this really is, in the new economy, this is the ball game of being able to have access to that seed money, and too many Oregon-based startups are just simply dying on the vine. And we have incredible research that is occurring, not just in our universities, this is statewide, but incredible research that is occurring. And the key, I think many folks would attest to, is the access to that seed money to grow that idea into a company. And you know what's a great example that's not technology-related is Gatorade. Started at the University of Florida, the idea for the athletic department there, which is, how do we provide a product to quench the thirst of our athletic department? Research was done, and a little seed money occurred, and they have a similar measure that we just passed where the universities can own equity, and so they founded Gatorade, and now it's obviously a Fortune 500 company and doing very, very well, but it came from a little idea and received that seed money, and that's where this is part of the OCAD recommendations, is how do we incentivize that seed money into the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair, may I also add that the $2 million per annum investment, required investment in Oregon, is the minimum amount. And the $75 million of freeboard, that is the amount that they have to invest, is again the minimum amount. Originally, we couldn't identify that there were very many companies that didn't have in excess of $150 million of freeboard. But in an attempt to draw back those companies who we know that might invest within Oregon, the smaller companies, we said if you will invest $2 million new money each year into the Oregon high-tech capital, venture capital markets, minimum, then that will establish. Our anticipation is those companies that come to Oregon, locate in Oregon, and establish here, are with $75 million to invest immediately, will likely make much larger investments in Oregon, not necessarily each investment being larger, but they may make many minimum from $2 to $5 million investments, and recognize that these are many times closed-in funds that have upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars already invested, and still with hundreds of millions of dollars freeboard. And those are the companies we're after. Those that are already investing in high tech that will move their headquarters to the state of Oregon, and out of the headquarters. All we ask is that key person, the key person who brings to Oregon the decision-making authority to hire and fire and to set up business in downtown metropolitan Oregon, will have an opportunity to apply to the OECD to be able to have an exemption, annual exemption on the income derived from his or her employment within that firm.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, thank you. Could you discuss just for a minute the other piece of this, which is the nanotechnology and the university faculty piece?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I think that is actually, we focus a lot on incenting the partner. Part of this is really the research that is occurring, and that's the university researcher part. It really is, and we shied away from it, but on the Council of Knowledge and Economic Development, we talked about, and it's a tough term, special people, but there really are folks that are doing research that is really changing. I mean, MIT is a good example. 60% of the Boston area economy is predicated on a lot of the research that has occurred at MIT, and it is that provision is really trying to attract, with the Oregon opportunity that we're doing at OHSU, with the signature research centers that's moving down in Ways and Means, this is really trying to incent those university researchers in microtechnology at OSU and nanotechnology at the University of Oregon, which is two research projects that really are what's unique to Oregon. And I would only say with the biotech that we're doing at OHSU, 31 other states are involved in really, really aggressively trying to position themselves for growth in the biotech arena. In terms of microtechnology and nanotechnology, it has a very fancy name, but some of these are very rudimentary projects. One is hydrogen fuel cell at Oregon State University, which we can hopefully produce into cars, and the companies can locate here, and it's those researchers that we're really trying to incent to Oregon. And now with this new ballot measure, to let the universities own equity stake in the companies as they spin out.
And Madam Chair, if I might, and Representative Berger, this is for new to Oregon employment as well. And again, when we talk about the pyramid for venture capital, the base of the pyramid may only have a dozen employees across the base, 10 or a dozen. The pyramid gets much larger when you move then to the research. When we go out looking for the intellectual capital and bring those high-level researchers, normally, those high-level researchers we found at OHSU, their staffs are much, much larger. The broad end of the base of the pyramid can include 100 or more people at the bottom end. And again, those are very high-end jobs, the researchers' jobs that support the brain trust at the top. Again, it was our colleague in the House, Representative King and his colleagues and his caucus that brought us this idea that what we needed to do was attract this intellectual capital back to Oregon and bring these folks back to Oregon to spur on education.
Mm-hmm. All right. Other questions?
So, Madam Chair, with that pyramid scheme, we just want to have copies all over the state of Oregon and net multi-level network these ideas.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here this morning. We appreciate it. And
thank
with
you.
That, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 362A.
I think you got one.
Oh, I'm sorry, Patrick. I will reopen. I knew you were. I was fixing to call you up. Patrick Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Chair Verger, my name is Patrick Green. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO and the Oregon Revenue Coalition, and we're here to testify to our opposition to Senate Bill 362. And it's basically, I don't know where to start, so I'll just leap right in. One of the things in response to what Senator Deckert and Representative Butler had said was, Senator Deckert gave a series of examples, Sequence and Digimark and TriQuint and Mentor Graphics, all who had received, Oregon companies who had received venture capital. They did it without, they received venture capital from venture capital firms without any tax incentive to do so. They did it because they had, it was the entrepreneurial spirit and they had a good idea that was worth funding. So my question is, are we basically looking at starting a tax incentive for something that is already going to happen in the right circumstances? Further, the bill says that investment alone, investment in and of itself, is a good, right, and will produce a good. But it doesn't necessarily. It can produce losses. It can produce nothing. And there's no job guarantees. For all the talk about jobs, what are the job guarantees? What is the outcome measure in terms of job creation for this bill? There's none. We could, and in exchange for that, we're going to give tax amnesty to people with nothing guaranteed, nothing on the other side in terms of outcome measures. We could invest all this money in Oregon startups and nothing happens. I mean, that happens. That's one of the things, one of the risks of being a venture capitalist. Venture capitalists have a lot of money and they throw it around and they can either win big or lose big. The other thing that is one of the things that is the most outrageous about this bill is that it would basically provide tax amnesty, tax freedom for the ultra rich. So you would have a venture capital firm that could move here, and the receptionist in the office would pay more in taxes than the person with the tax amnesty certificate. We have unemployed workers who are paying more in taxes in their unemployment benefits than these venture capitalists would pay should this bill pass. In that respect, they talked. You know, it was referred to as a pyramid. It is a pyramid scheme. The person at the top doesn't pay any taxes, but we're reliant. You know, we're looking forward to the taxes that will be produced if these jobs somehow materialize. So on the job outcome measure, I'm wondering, if there is a way that we could have some sort of job guarantees. Maybe that could become part of the bill. But Willamette Week did an article on this bill, and they interviewed venture capitalists in Oregon and said there was a paucity of companies to invest in anyway. So it may not be for lack of venture capital. It may be for lack of Oregon startups. Basically back to the tax amnesty thing, which just is outrageous. I just want to read a quote from Tom McCall, who said many years ago, "Oregon is demure and lovely, and it ought to play a little hard to get. And I think you'll all be just as sick as I am if you find it is nothing more but a hungry hussy throwing herself at every stinking smokestack that's offered." And I think that we can, I think that that says it all. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Patrick. Questions for Patrick? One of the things, Patrick, that I'd like for you to comment on, and I think we all want to bring jobs. I think that's the answer to so much of our problem right now, is this lack of money coming into the state, and it is because we don't have enough to spread around and enough people working, and we do have companies leaving here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the trade-off here is for, if you're going to have a tax exemption, that there be some guarantee? When you said maybe we should have the guarantee as a part of that, are you saying that maybe then you would look at this tax exemption? Are you really not saying that at all? You're just saying that you think job guarantee should be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I think that the emphasis should be, if the point is to create jobs, then we should have an economic development strategy that's about creating jobs. And one of the things that we've testified, that I myself have testified in front of this committee, is that, you know, at the very beginning of the session, Paul Warner showed how the industries were going, right? And one of the big ones was medicine and healthcare. And I know that we have limited resources, but one of the things that we know, you know, in Hearing Room F, is that if you spend money to leverage federal funds, you can double your money, right? One-to-one match. So if we're talking about giving away money, if we're talking about providing incentives or spending money that's going to generate more jobs, we have an industry, a healthcare industry. If we spend or incent $500 million, we can get another $500 million from the state feds. That helps in terms of the overall revenue, and those are jobs, and they're needed jobs. You know, but it's sort of like thinking along those lines versus this, which is, you know, a venture capitalist could essentially move to the state and invest $2 million a year in Oregon small business, which is a good thing. You know, we're all for more business investment, but then nothing happens, and this person pays no taxes. And what do we show for it other than the fact that they moved here and paid property taxes on their mansion, right? I mean, versus some of the other programs we've testified about, like the strategic investment program, it's more local, there's more guarantees, there's clawback provisions. It feels like that sort of arrangement is more of a contract between equals. Whereas this one feels like desperation. This is going to be the only group of people who pay no taxes on their, personal income taxes. And it's just, you know, when unemployed workers in the Dalles have their shut down aluminum plants, and they're paying more in taxes than a venture capitalist. It's outrageous.
I have one more last quick question, and you can respond or not respond. But do you feel, if you were a company and were looking for a place to come and establish and create jobs, irregardless of the tax picture, do you believe that Oregon is friendly to job creation and to companies coming here?
I think it is. I think that one of the things that's been most frustrating sitting in this hearing room is the number of business representatives who have come to this chair and talk down Oregon in terms of being so unfriendly for business. I mean, Washington and Utah have done national sort of analysis of business taxes, and Oregon has the lowest business tax burden of the 11 Western states. You know, if taxes is a measure of business friendliness, I think that we're pretty friendly. And then the other thing in terms of, in answer to your question, Representative Verger, because this is a key thing that we keep seeing about, is it taxes? What causes people to move here? And quote from Paul O'Neill, the CEO of Alcoa and Treasury Secretary, said, "As a businessman, I have never made an investment decision based on the tax code. If you are giving money away, I will take it. If you want to give me inducements for something I'm going to do anyway, I will take it." I think that the point about Governor Tom McCall talking about Oregon being demure and lovely, and there are lots of reasons for people to come to the state. It's beautiful. We have smart kids in schools. There's lots of reasons to move here, but it's not a tax giveaway.
I would agree with you on that, except I will tell you that there are a lot of lovely places to go. So we do have a certain amount of competition. All right. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.
All right. Now I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 363. I see John here, but I think the chairman would have liked to have talked to you about another bill, but I think I'll wait since he's not here. And if there's no other business to come before this body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.